deep left into the bleachers. A two-run homer.
A swing and a miss. Ball game.
Liftoff.
And history marches on. 22 consecutive wins.
From the sports desk of the Akron Beacon Journal and Ohio.com, this is Leading Off with Ryan Lewis, a podcast on Cleveland baseball.
Santana makes the catch. Ball game. The Indians have won the American League pennant. The Cleveland Indians are going to the World Series.
Now, Ryan Lewis and Ashley Fastar.
Welcome to Leading Off, a podcast on Cleveland baseball. I'm Ashley Bastock, here with our beat writer at the Akron Beacon Journal, Ryan Lewis. Ryan, I have to ask, we're recording this on Thursday, May 13th. Did you watch the latest episode of Handmaid's Tale? Because yes, I personally have changed my viewing habits because I'm afraid you're going to ask me about it, and I have to look pop culturally knowledgeable on the record here.
Yeah, I was hoping that was the question. Yeah. The entire week trying to figure out how I can slowly and maybe in a subtle way turn this into a Handmaid's Tale podcast.
It has to be subtle, it has to be slow, like just come along on the ride with us folks.
Like, could June Osborne handle the hot corner? Like, can she make that throw on a consistent enough basis, or does she need to play second? These are the things that we can tackle.
I think June definitely needs to play second. Like, I can't see her in the hot corner at all. I don't think she can make that throw. And maybe it's because I'm very anti-June after the last, like, season and a half, and some people may call me a hater or disagree with me, but June has, like, kind of sucked lately, so.
Well, I couldn't remember. Has she ever thrown, like, a shoe or a brick? I can't remember.
No, I don't.
It's been tested.
I feel like no, right? Like, I don't know. You've watched all of these episodes more recently than I have because I just refuse to rewatch them at this point. But you binged it, so you have a different perspective.
Yeah, it's really weird how that can, like, really change your view. Because it's a different experience watching one and then waiting a week, which is painful now. After going through three seasons in, like, 3 weeks, watching one episode and then seeing the credits roll, and you just sit there like, there's so much more time before the next one.
Yeah, and like, if you are watching this show along with us here on the Leading Off podcast, Cleveland Baseball Handmaid's Tale podcast now apparently, there was a crazy, crazy cliffhanger ending at, what was this, episode 5? Like, crazy cliffhanger episode, which definitely could change the trajectory of the series, I think, if it's done.
It's pretty common, too, but
yeah.
I mean, we can't talk about specifics because we are but a humble baseball podcast, so I wouldn't want to even allude to any spoilers. But I'm enjoying the season, and it's been a while. It's been like a year since a show really just like monopolized all of my interest like this. Since like maybe Peaky Blinders or Schitt's Creek at the very beginning of quarantine, which was right after Tiger King.
Yeah. Man, the Tiger King feels like 10 years ago, man. And Carol Baskin was like trending yesterday. I'm like, what is this? March 2020? But obviously it's not, because thankfully we have sports. So moving on from Handmaid's Tale corner of the podcast to Wednesday, when Cleveland gets a 2-1 extra innings win over the Cubs. Ahmed Rosario got the walk-off bases loaded single there. He drove in the first run of the game as well for Cleveland, in the sixth inning with a double. But what I really want to talk about here, and you wrote about him, is Sam Henches, or should we say Sam Francona. And if you've listened to our podcast before, you know why they call him that, jokingly, lovingly. He got his first major league start on Wednesday. He tossed 4 2/3 scoreless innings. He allowed 4 hits and 4 walks with 6 strikeouts. And, you know, his command wasn't quite there all the time, but the Cubs still made little contact against his curveball and his slider, right?
Yeah, and he remains one of the most interesting players within the entire system. Cleveland has had so much pitching development success recently. There's so many younger pitchers that you can go back a couple of years at any point in time. You could name like so many different guys as pitchers that the franchise has been high on, pitchers that have continued to develop, you know, maybe above where, you know, maybe people on the outside may have thought where they stood as prospects or just in terms of their potential. You know, Cleveland's been able to kind of eclipse that over and over and over again with their pitching development. And that's why they could trade Kluber and Clevinger and Carrasco and Bauer and still have this type of a rotation and this many options kind of left over. And Henches is maybe the most interesting piece out of all of them, as a guy who can, you know, he hit 97 yesterday with his fastball. And as you know, you kind of mentioned, he didn't always have his command. It wasn't the most efficient 4 2/3. But the Cubs made almost no contact on his curveball or his slider. In fact, they didn't put a ball in play against his curveball. And while he didn't always have his command, you know, I cited some numbers about, you know, I want to see through like 20-ish curveballs. I think he had 10 called strikes and whiffs. You know, that pitch, especially when a pitcher's ahead with, you know, with any pitch, but especially with breaking pitches, you know, that next pitch isn't always supposed to be a strike. You know, you don't always want to give somebody something to hit when you're ahead 0-2. And he was at times, you know, in positions like that. But especially later on, he did start to miss some spots, you know, which was kind of the downside of his outing. He only went 4 2/3. He is being stretched out kind of on the fly at the major league level. You know, this was technically his first career start. He got up to, I think, like 84 pitches. You know, that's not the easiest thing to handle either, but it's an interesting thing to follow because as Cleveland, you know, stays in this race or tries to stay in this race with Chicago and KC and maybe Minnesota, if they can kind of turn some things around, Sam Henches' long-term development is just such an interesting kind of path to follow because of his stuff and because of kind of his situation and that three-pitch mix, you know, does come with, I guess, some legitimate concerns about how he's going to handle, you know, a more complete workload or a more complete start, you know, for a starting pitcher and getting through that lineup the second time and then the third time. You hear all the time that the pitchers are, you know, trying to work on like a changeup. Shane Bieber is actually a perfect example of this, and that even when a pitcher has success to a certain degree, you know, Shane Bieber still has worked on a changeup for years. Last year, he implemented a cutter a little bit just to give hitters a little extra look, just to keep them a little more off balance, but especially the second or third time through the order in that you're not showing them everything so early. So that's kind of something to watch, I think, with Henches. But, yeah, I mean, the franchise is very high on him as they've been high on a lot of pitchers. He was effective. He, you know, 4 walks and 4 2/3 scoreless is not ideal, but the Cubs were not making very much contact, very much hard contact, and especially on his breaking pitches. So, you know, I don't think there's anything that, you know, extinguished any of the franchise's excitement toward his, you know, potential. There's a lot of things that remain to be seen with him, you know, especially as he continues to be stretched out as a full workload, you know, style starting pitcher. When you can hit 97 with your fastball, and I think he averaged, you know, below that, of course, but, you know, when you can hit 97 on your fastball, and then you've got a curveball that I think was around like 80 or 81 miles per hour on average, the slider sat at 86. You know, when he can command, he could do some damage. So, you know, we'll see how this kind of plays out as he continues to be stretched out. But if he can continue to, you know, to be that at least effective, they'd love for him to be a little more efficient, but if he can at least be effective, you know, that spot in the rotation will be his. And he joins, you know, a long list of younger pitchers, either at the major league or the AAA level that they're pretty high on.
I mean, for me, I think the interesting thing with him that I'm obviously super early in the season, super early in his major league career. But, you know, you look at like what Shane Bieber did over the last, you know, 3-4 years. He makes his debut in 2018. Like, how many people really thought he would have this ascendant rise that he did and, you know, become not just the ace of the Cleveland, but become one of the best pitchers in Major League Baseball. They were talking about that a little bit on the broadcast. I think Andre Knott brought it up. So I'm definitely like super interested in those like hypotheticals. And obviously none of us can predict the future, but I mean, I think it's kind of an interesting point and something to, you know, kind of consider when you look at how Cleveland's developed some of these guys.
Yeah. And you know, something that they've mentioned is that for so long, Corey Kluber was just the gold standard of
yeah, right.
how the franchise wanted younger pitchers to go about their business and how they wanted them to handle their off days and just kind of that focus, that attention to detail that Kluber always had. And Shane Bieber, maybe not in exactly the same way, but pretty close and to a pretty close level, has already taken that over, even though Shane's so much younger and, you know, so much more, I get not more, cause you know, Kluber was always there, but Shane has been applauded by so many, within the organization for being mature for his age and, you know, younger pitchers being able to see, you know, Shane have the season that he had last year, which, you know, for 60 games, he was the best pitcher on the planet. And then to, you know, to hear what he said over the off season and this spring that, you know, he was upset to say the least with how Cleveland's postseason ended. He was upset with how he performed against the Yankees in that series, that he's still working on this. He's still working on that. He has, you know, this goal. He still feels like he has this to prove, you know, things like that. You know, and Bieber developing pitches, which is something that, you know, quite a few younger pitchers have had to do as they've progressed, because eventually sometimes you do need that extra look just to keep guys off balance. And, you know, Shane's continued, you know, focus on that is something that anyone in the organization can see is a bright spot, to where they can tell any younger pitcher coming up, like, hey, here's what this guy did and look how it worked out. And as long as you have that example there, you know, that can carry some extra value.
Yeah. Let's move to the bullpen here from Wednesday. James Karinchak came in to pitch the top of the 10th, got himself out of a tricky situation. Obviously, he had the runner starting on second. Then he walked Jason Hayward, and then got three outs there to get himself out of any damage. But what really kind of went viral, thanks, and you wrote about it in your walk-off thoughts, is the K-strut after the fact, after he got that last out in the 10th. And, you know, that term has been popularized on Twitter thanks to Pitching Ninja. So you can go and, I assume if you listen to this podcast, you already probably follow him on Twitter. You can read it. You can see the video in Ryan's story if you weren't watching the broadcast yesterday. Just the way James Karinchak celebrates, he's yelling all the way to the mound. Really just fun stuff. And I know we've never talked about it on here, but I guess just like, where do you stand on the bat flips, on the pitchers yelling as they're walking off the mound, all that stuff? Because I personally love it. Like, I know baseball purists tend to hate that kind of stuff. Obviously, it's an argument I think that is going to be had forever and always in Major League Baseball about whether or not people should do it. But I love it. I mean, I'm laughing just thinking about it now. Like, it just is so fun. And I think Trevor Bauer has actually been pretty outspoken about this. Like, yeah, like, he's going to do what he's going to do, but like, he's not going to get mad at bat flips then. Like, it's kind of like that mutual, as long as there's that mutual understanding and all of these players are kind of on the same page, then great. But I mean, I think it's great. I think it's entertaining.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I think the game needs it. I think it's great for the game. And yeah, Bauer has been outspoken on it. You know, I talked with Jake Bowers actually, you know, a couple years ago in 2019, when he was in the majors, kind of about this and how if a guy flips his bat and then he gets thrown out the next time, Jake had some colorful language for it. There were other guys in Cleveland's clubhouse at that time that just, you know, a lot of guys, especially the younger guys, you know, this generation, they're not fans of that. They're not fans of the idea of throwing at someone for that reason. So in terms of showing emotion, you know, there is kind of that line of, you know, try not to show up the other team. And if you're going to do it, if you're going to flip your bat, don't be angry if that pitcher, you know, yells after he strikes you out the next time, or vice versa. If you're going to yell and strut off the mound, don't be mad when the guy flips his bat on you. So as long as that's kind of understood, I think most guys I think that's starting to evolve a little bit. Definitely not 100%, you know, acceptance, but I think that's starting to evolve a little bit. I think that's great. Those highlights should be everywhere. There was one that went around. I think it was a high school game. Kid hit a home run and kind of was yelling and kind of threw his bat more than flipped it. but he's looking toward his dugout. He's pumped up. And, you know, of course it gets all these reactions of, you know, this is terrible and there's no respect for the game. And then people added context, like those schools may have been rivals. It was a game where I think that kid's team was down like 12 to nothing or 12 to one. And that home run put him up 13-12 or something like that. like some crazy comeback, maybe in a big game, maybe in a rivalry game. That's awesome. It's awesome for the game. And I think pitchers yelling should even do it. I think that's closer to like highlight reel level stuff as bat flips. Like bat flips get all the pub, it seems. All the highlights, all the, and they also get all of the like criticism for some reason. But I think pitchers yelling is great. Even if it's in like the sixth inning, you know, if the pitcher's had 115 pitches, it's been a rough start. He's had to grind through not his best stuff. He strikes out some MVP candidate, maybe with the bases loaded in a high leverage situation to end his inning, keep his team ahead, whatever. That's awesome. Yell, fist pump, you know, gesture to your dugout, whatever. I think it's great for the game. I don't think that players need to be buttoned up all the time. I don't think that it's disrespecting the other club just because there's emotion. Now, if you like walk toward the other dugout and you're gesturing and you're like motioning for guys that, you know, to come out and fight you, okay, that might be over the line. But like, if you're walking, if you're looking at your own dugout and your own guys, and I think there's an understanding that it's not personal in that moment. It's just showing emotion. It's a big deal.
And it's added fun. Like, I don't know. Like, I just think it's overall fun. Like you said, there's a line of disrespect, obviously, that you cannot cross. And I think you rarely see that happen. Like, one of my favorite moments from this season was when Fernando Tatis Jr. hit that home run off Bauer in that series. And Bauer, you know, in spring training was kind of, you know, being Trevor Bauer and jerking around with certain things. And he was pitching to the Padres with one eye closed. So Tatis is rounding the bases and covers his eye. Like, that's awesome to me. And of course, Bauer's not going to throw at him the next at bat or anything, but it just is fun. And that went viral. And that was like one of the most talked about moments, I think, from this season too.
Yeah. And I mean, those guys, you know, that rivalry has been fantastic this season, like especially like centered on, you know, Bauer and Tatis, and then Tatis goes yard again and does the Colin McGregor strut as he crosses home plate. And I mean, those guys understand that, you know, if Bauer strikes Tatis out, Trevor may do the McGregor strut around the mound. I think one of the most ridiculous things that the NFL did for a long time was to kind of throw like a wet blanket on any attempt to celebrate a touchdown. It's a big moment.
Yeah.
Let God celebrate. And it's like a home run or a huge strikeout in a key moment. Those are just big moments. They should be celebrated. It just makes the game fun. And Karinchak striking Sogard out in that moment, that's a huge strikeout.
Yeah.
And
that was a long at bat. Like, he had to battle to get that strikeout.
That too. Yeah, right. That too. It was an eight pitch at bat.
Yeah.
He strikes Sogard out. He puts Cleveland in a position where they already have the potential winning run at second base. You know, their chances of winning shot up with that pitch. It should be celebrated. I think it's great in every case that it doesn't, you know, clearly show someone else up. And even then, I might not be as against it as I probably should be, but the energy is great. I think it should continue.
We have the same take, which is great. So moving on to the Tuesday win over Chicago, just kind of going to quickly, it's your weekly Shane Bieber corner here. He struck out eight. He's now gone 20 consecutive starts with at least eight Ks, went 6 2/3 innings, threw 121 pitches. So another start, we talked about this a lot last week, that he kind of had to grind out there. A lot of that grinding through his starts recently has to do with his slider. He threw it 25 times in Tuesday night's game. Six called strikes, you wrote, plus whiffs, but he hasn't been happy with it.
Yeah, and this actually kind of leads into what we're talking about with Sam Henches, and that, you know, there's a reason that pitchers really try to develop additional pitches to where they're not just, you know, an option where you can throw every now and then, but can be kind of a weapon. You know, there's kind of different levels as you're developing a pitch with how effective it can be and how much of an effect it can have on your other pitches. And that's kind of the main goal. It's not just to have a changeup. It's so that, you know, hitters can't key in on something else, you know, as often. And Shane right now is going through really a couple start stretch where he hasn't always had his best stuff, and he's had to grind a little bit. And that's, you know, with any younger ace, that's always something that teams talk about, and that you're going to have to learn how to do this. And, you know, Shane has. It just, this is the kind of the stretch that he's going through right now, and it's in part due to his slider where it's not where he wants it to be. It's not quite moving like he wants it to move. So he may have to shift a little bit his percentages with his other offerings. And that's why, you know, we talk about with Henches, and that if he entered, you know, his next start, talking about Sam, and he doesn't have the feel for his curveball at all. You're left with a fastball and a slider, and on a starter's workload trying to get through the lineup multiple times, that's not very easy. There's a reason that Shane has kind of added to his arsenal over the last couple of years, and it's these times, you know, that's the reason, is that when you're having to really grind and you don't have your best stuff, that you can still get through, you know, six or seven innings effectively. Maybe not as efficiently, but effectively. You know, Shane is still putting up some solid numbers, not quite as eye popping, of course, but some pretty solid numbers. He's the only pitcher in baseball to ever strike out at least 8 in 20 consecutive starts, but he's starting to labor a little bit to get to 8, which, you know, that also, you know, getting to 8 isn't the end goal. It's to go as deep into the game as possible, but the effectiveness hasn't quite been 2020 Shane Bieber-esque, although it might never be again, because, you know, those numbers are just almost unattainable. But, you know, he was still effective. He's grinding right now. You know, and that's something else to watch. You know, to see how he handles a stretch like this after the success that he's had.
Yeah. And, but the real focus of your walk-off thoughts from that game was Cesar Hernandez. He came through with a go-ahead 2-run homer on Tuesday. And, you know, we talked so much about Jake Bowers last week in this context of expected results versus actual results. And you wrote about this, that no two situations are obviously ever going to be identical, especially in baseball. But this is a pretty close comparison, I think, between these two guys and in describing the early parts of their 2021.
Yeah, I mean, we could basically just like
copy and paste that combo.
Yeah, and just put Cesar in there instead of Jake Bowers. It just so happens that Cleveland has had two of the leading hitters in baseball in terms of, you could kind of say that they've been two of the unluckier hitters in baseball based on certain quality of contact metrics, that their actual results have not matched their expected results in a negative way, and that they should have expected better results than what they've gotten. And, you know, those two guys are both in the top 10 or 20, depending on how you look at it, and as the numbers evolve, those guys are both really high up there. And it just so happens that they're in the same lineup. You know, so we're going to start running, I know at some point, we'll start doing like some primers on these numbers. Hopefully enough context has been given kind of on the fly quickly to at least give people an idea. We think context is important, so we're actually going to start running a series at some point looking at, you know, WOBA and wins above replacement and FIP and WRC+, just to allow everyone to have, you know, an extra chance to get some extra context, because I appreciate, you know, when people tweet or email me kind of asking, you know, I saw you use this number, can you give me, you know, more of an idea of how it's used or what it means? Because again, in not to go over everything that we talked about last week, but, you know, using analytics like this is important because they have become part of the game, and they have become part of teams' decision-making processes. And because of that, because it's like integrated into how the game evolves now and just how the game works, I think it has to be reflected in how we cover the game as well. So hopefully enough context has been there to where everything is clear. Basically, with these quality of contact metrics and realized versus expected results and the difference between what you should have gotten and what you got, basically just means is that on average, you know, we can track based on this quality of contact and this walk rate and this strikeout rate, things like that. We can track what the average hitter should expect based on, you know, that level of contact, things like that. On average, across the league, here's what would normally happen. So that's what it's saying. It's not guaranteeing anything moving forward, and it's not saying that everything's fine with this hitter. It's just saying that there's a big difference, and probably, you know, that hitter has been better than what his traditional stat line would indicate. That's all it's trying to say. It's just trying to say that, you know, maybe things aren't as bad as they seem. Maybe, you know, not saying it's in this case, in general, it can say maybe, you know, a significant swing change is not needed, or a roster move is not needed. And that's why it's important. That's why teams use it. That's why they're continuing to be used in reporting. So hopefully that, you know, hopefully we'll continue to add some context, and it'll become clearer and clearer for those who have maybe held on to the traditional stat lines for a while, which is fine. It's just an effort to give a more complete picture of what's really going on. So that's why we use them. Cesar Hernandez, Jake Bowers are both right there still toward the top of the league in terms of numbers indicating that they've been better than their traditional stat line would show. St. Louis has Matt Carpenter, who is like first or second on all of those lists. He's by far been, statistically the unluckiest hitter in baseball. But an argument could be made that, two guys in Cleveland's lineup are probably in the top 10 or so, top 10, top 12, both of them. And, talking about Hernandez, he's a huge part of Cleveland kind of unlocking this lineup. And, they've needed someone to kind of set the table in front of Ramirez and in front of Reyes. And they've done some different things with the number two spot in the lineup, which Tito kind of acknowledged, I think, 2 days ago that they're kind of trying some different things and on different days and kind of being a little creative with it in terms of how they handle it. But at the top of the lineup, he's a big part of that. And so him kind of getting going would be another boost, on top of Josh Naylor coming around a little bit, on top of Bowers coming around a little bit. Those are things that can really help. And it's been a huge piece to how, it's Thursday afternoon. As of right now, Cleveland's won 8 of their last 9 games and they're 20-14. And that's the lengthening of the lineup is a big part of that.
Yeah. A couple of newsier things to hit on here before we leave. Obviously, Cleveland got no hit once again over since we last recorded. It's the first time in franchise history they've been no hit twice in the same season, let alone, like you wrote, in the first 6 weeks of the season. Cleveland is now the 18th team in baseball history to be no hit twice in the same season. And it's just kind of bizarre to me that, like, Cleveland hadn't been no hit since 2011. Irvin Santana did it on July 27th, 2011. And now we've gotten 2 in the first 2 months of this season. Like, it just is so, so, so strange.
Yeah. It feels like we're headed for a record breaking, no hit season with this, with the ball and what they've kind of done to it and how pitchers have been able to utilize that. Yeah. Tito made a joke about Cleveland has responded to the no hitters pretty well. They put up 9 runs the next night after Wade Miley's. But he kind of jokes that he hopes he's not asked this, 4 or 5 more times this season.
Yeah.
No team in baseball has ever been no hit 3 times in the same season. So Cleveland has a long way to go to not join that list or not start that list, I guess. Yeah, it's not ideal for a lineup. Then again, if the team responds with 3 consecutive wins, which Cleveland has done, it is one loss. People tweeting that the season's over, but they've won 3 straight and they're 20-14. I mean, it's certainly frustrating to watch your team get no hit twice as a fan, I'm sure. But Cleveland has responded well to it. Hey, if you tell most teams that you're going to get no hit tonight, but you'll win the next 3 or 4 for sure, a lot of teams would take that.
Right, right. It's like 24 hours of negative headlines and bad feeling, and you get to move on.
Yeah, and that 9th inning and that no-hitter was extremely strange with Rosario being off the base a little bit and Clase throwing it away. But Cleveland's won 3 consecutive straight. They have a chance to join some not so great history, but they've kind of corrected that ship a little bit, I guess.
Yeah, and Rosario kind of, he has the game he has yesterday, and it's funny because earlier in the week, and we were going to plug this, but your 3-up, 3-down story that got published on Monday, I believe, on the off day. So everyone should go and check that out still, but Rosario was one of the guys that was in the 3-down. And now I think if a few days later, he kind of makes up for it, at least with his hitting yesterday. So go check that out, like I said, on Monday. Ryan wrote that. You can find it on social media or on beaconjournal.com. I believe that's a subscriber exclusive story. So be sure to do what you got to do to read that. And then the other newsy item here that definitely is storyline to watch, I think, the next couple of months, potentially. Roberto Perez underwent surgery on his fractured right ring finger on Friday. So last Friday, just not a good day for Cleveland baseball fans. Just a rough couple of hours there between that and the no-hitter. An estimate of 8 to 10 weeks before he can return, which would put his return in early to mid-July.
Yeah, and kind of the level of how much this could hurt Cleveland's lineup. You know, well, first off, defensively, of course, you know, Perez has been, you know, known for a long time of how he handles the pitching staff and how he handles the running game as being one of the best defensive catchers in baseball, maybe the best defensive catcher in baseball, at least for stretches. So that's a big loss defensively. Offensively is kind of the bigger variable maybe in terms of how much this is going to, you know, hurt, in that it depends what Perez Cleveland might have been getting. Because at the beginning of the season, he looked not only healthy, but at least as healthy for the first time in a long time.
Right.
Maybe dating back all the way to 2019. You know, he quickly hit two home runs. You know, Tito and a few other players, at least I think, you know, they all mentioned that his swing looks better. He looks healthy, and he had such a strong offensive year compared to expectations in 2019, to where, you know, if he can be a near league average hitter, or at least anywhere close to that, that would have been a huge boost to this lineup, or at least the bottom part of the lineup, because of what he brings defensively. Then he cools off. And so that certainly could have been solely due to this injury. It's something that he, you know, he did play with for a couple of weeks, you know, because this happened in the middle of the month when he and Karinchak got crossed up a little bit with a sign. So, you know, he had cooled down considerably, but it may have just been solely through this injury. So if Cleveland is losing the 2019 level of Roberto Perez offensively, this might be a really big loss, because Austin Hedges and Rene Rivera, you know, they're different levels of veterans. Hedges is also known for his defensive work. But offensively, between Hedges and a 37-year-old Rivera, you don't really know what you're going to get there. And so, you know, this could be something that really does hurt them for about 2 months. You know, it could be until July or maybe even later. You know, Tito mentioned, you know, this is going to be a rough estimate with this injury. So they're projecting 8 to 10 weeks, but that, you know, that it could be quite the window around that. So this, you know, this is something that, you know, that will have a fairly substantial effect potentially. I don't know if Perez's defensive, you know, work is always valued, maybe in as much as it should, or in every aspect as it should. But there's, you know, there's a reason that the pitchers, to a guy, always, you know, go out of their way to, you know, to recognize him, I guess, and just to kind of acknowledge that they're pretty thankful to be here, that they're thankful to be to be able to be caught by guys like Perez and Hedges. And it just puts more on Hedges' shoulders to kind of handle that. And Rene Rivera just very quickly will become a much bigger part of this club. So, you know, this is something that definitely could be quite an impactful loss. And this handling this and kind of getting through this as Cleveland chases Chicago and as they were kind of race KC and Minnesota, you know, it's certainly one of the top headlines now.
Well, kind of a bummer there a little bit to end on talking about an injury, but we've already gone pretty long. Like I said, we got to plug your 3-up, 3-down story from earlier in the week, and really encourage people to read that, plus Ryan's walk-off thoughts after most games at beaconjournal.com. You can find him on Twitter at @byRyanLewis. I'm Ashley Bastock. Find me at AshleyBastock42. And until next time, hopefully Cleveland does not get no hit between now and next Thursday with the next time we record.
We'll see.